Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. About a minute late, but I guess that's what happens when you are Lauren Tenney. Actually, I've been pretty good about time. I don't even want to talk about it because I don't want to jinx myself. How are you all doing out there? I hope things are going well. I know that there's been lots of activity in different ways in recent times, and that there are a lot of people who are fighting and a lot of people who are struggling and a lot of people who are just trying to get through the day. And so it's good to be in touch. If you'd like to call in and be part of the show, area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Part of the reason I was delayed was because I had been writing notes for these shows and everything else on the back of draft pages of the dissertation, which was like 600 some odd pages long. And I just, flipped over the stack of paper, and it happened to be on a section heading, and so I got delayed because I started reading it. I was like, "Huh, this is pretty good. I think people would like this. I think people would be interested in this." And then I wondered, can you tweet a dissertation? Is that possible? Like in 140 character segments, get it out, and then would that remove copyright issues? I don't know. Copyright issues, because I used a lot of really long quotes, sometimes from specific people like Irving Goffman, because I wanted people to hear exactly what he had to say, or Grob, for that matter, in The Mad Among Us, or Andrew Scull in Madhouse, that I didn't want to, either water down what it was that they were saying by trying to rewrite it and paraphrase, or B, write it as strong as they had written it, using different strong language as they had used, and be accused of, blowing up the situation to be more than it is. So I didn't really do either. So I've got all these copyright issues with the dissertation. 267-521-0167 if you'd like to talk with me. So this section called Dehumanization from Antiquity Voiced, I thought I might read a little bit of. And so it says, this dissertation process held the historical moment in high esteem. One of the challenges of historical work is to understand the lived experience of the era. For some of this research, that means imagining a time with no modern conveniences, such as light bulbs and electricity, indoor plumbing or heating and ventilation systems, computers or the internet. As we travel back to the year 1620, relying on Gail Hornstein's, I think in this version it was the third version of first-person stories of madness from 2005. So we'll travel back to the year 1620, linger in the decade before the Civil War, focusing on The Opal, which was written and edited by the inmates of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum in New York State from 1851 to 1860, the decade before the Civil War, and then progress to the advent of modern psychology and psychiatry in the mid-20th century. We conclude our trip at the time of the current moment, where there has never been more awareness on the part of psychiatric systems, governments, and people assigned as quote-unquote diseased by psychiatry, of how consistently, historically, the system has been criticized with a response of changing what they called what was done instead of what was being done. So with a response of changing what it was they called what they were doing instead of actually changing what they do. And of course, this is what they continue to do. Implicit to this conversation and the point of historical work is guidance for what not to do, is why the entire state-sponsored organized psychiatric industry and its systems must change its fundamental practices, not what they are called. In addition, In addition to academic sources and materials generated from the movement, the Mental Patients Liberation Movement, the Consumer Movement, the Survivor Movement, the Ex-Patient Movement, the Human Rights Movement, when I say the movement, those are some of the movements that I refer to, the MAD Movement, I have utilized reports from the 19th century, including reports from the Commission on Lunacy, the Superintendent's reports, reports to the legislature from the managers of the Utica State Lunatic Asylum, the Journal of Insanity, which I have found in various locations on the internet, in libraries, and the Oneida County Historical Society's collected papers on the Utica State Lunatic Asylum in New York. And of course, one of the Journal of Insanities was liberated and given to me, the 1851-1852 one, which really explodes the entire situation. So again, 267-521-0167 if you'd like to talk with me. I am willing to stop at any second. I think 267-521-0167 if you'd like to call in. Okay, so the dissertation, and I'm on page 375 here. For the purposes of this archival research from more modern times, I've used materials on the internet from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, from the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, NASHBED, and the New York State Office of Mental Health as sources to understand both the evolution and devolution of change in the master system of psychiatry. At least since the 1620 petition of the poor and distracted people in the House of Bedlam in England, which looked to add protections into the environments in which inmates were forced to live, which I found through Hornstein's work, people who are subjected to systems of behavior and thought control have rallied themselves, each other, and entire governments and societies to change. While historians and people who have been subjected to mental institutions have gathered a great amount of information about the lived experiences of psychiatric inmates, there is another factor weighing in. Much of the history of this population of people has either been erased, buried, or simply unrecorded. To complicate this, much of these existing histories are in small clusters of work that have been done at varying points in time, focused on some in modern times. And I think that people really should check out Pat Deegan's work, David Gonzalez, Penny and Stasny, Darby Penny and Peter Stasny's work, Pat Risser's timeline, and a wealth of other information that really that's out there about the history. Judy Chamberlain, I mean, obviously, that is something that we've backed off of. I make a specific point that, as a note, I make no such claims of devoiced being that authoritative, complete history. Rather, I see what I have compiled as yet another version of this story, which has been attempted to be told for centuries with actionable consequences, and which still so many of us have yet to be found and written in its detail. Area code 202, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, this is Yvonne.
Hey, Yvonne, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I want to make an announcement later about a online protest, but I wanted to ask you if you knew, what's the best way to take possession of these archives? I know the last time I asked this broke my heart because at St. Elizabeth's, which is the equivalent of the state hospital here, right in my neighborhood, that's like a over 150-year hospital, I know during the time that I have been around for the last like 20 years that I know of, they had been taking, you know, film and pictures and stuff. And I asked the person who took a lot of the pictures that I know over the last maybe 20 years who's still there, you know, where were those pictures? And they said they had to get rid of them when they built the new hospital.
Of course they did.
Yeah, somebody at my door.
Oh, what a shame. What a disgrace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, destroy it or whatever.
St. Elizabeth, you know, is from the D-Voice, just because I've been stuck in D-Voice for the last 40 minutes or so, traveling down memory lane. Irving Goffman, who wrote Asylums, that the whole basis of that book, he got the data for while he was undercover at St. Elizabeth. He was pretending to be a recreation assistant as a college student doing some internship. But he really worked for NIMH, and the only person who knew who he really was the director of St. Elizabeth's. I write all about it. I'll try to dig that section up and get the actual, but yeah, he wrote about it in his preface, that was how he got the data for Asylums. And of course it's in Asylums where he lays out, I mean, Goffman, he was a conservative sociologist that did work around, like, prior to that, like, one of the things he did while he was at NIMH was work around the psychological phenomena of embarrassment and of what it means to be embarrassed from a, you know, white privileged male perspective in 1950. You know, his book after Asylums was called Stigma, where he really addressed more like issues of discrimination that people of color faced or people who had disabilities faced. And what he suggested that people do was that they should make fun of themselves first so all of the other people would feel more comfortable. You know, like this was the cutting edge of NIMH in the 1960s, early 1960s. So, you know, pre-68, right? Pre-everything. Or the way everything was for then. And so, but what Goffman, this conservative, really non-with-it kind of guy in terms of progressiveness, came up with was that in St. Elizabeth's, in mental institutions, there is a two-stage process that turns a person into a mental patient, and that this is done by contaminative exposure, which I've had some disagreement with some people about, and I can see it their way, but some people can't always see it my way, that the contaminative exposure, that being a person who could be treated like this, that the person is the what is contaminated. I see it as contaminative exposure, a person that this can be done, that these things can be done to. And what he listed as the tools of contaminative exposure were things like electroshock, beatings, force feeding, you know, being subjected to drugging, force drugging.
Force feeding in San Luis, but in fact, a lot of people don't realize this. I got some historical paper. Maybe I can make copies and send it to you. But during the suffragette movement, when they had protests here, mm-hmm. they take women and Elizabeth knocked their teeth out and force feed them when they didn't want to eat. I mean, they just didn't have psychiatric patients there too. They had I guess they considered that you were ill. You were protesting for women suffragettes.
In terms of like fasting.
Yeah, and in terms of that, in fact, in some of the old buildings are still there. They got cages where they kept people in.
Right.
They haven't torn them down yet.
See, and things like that there should be pictures of, but what you're saying is that even the things from before, once the new buildings went up, the pictures were destroyed, the evidence was destroyed.
They had lots of artwork, and they had, even when I would go, every time they had some event or something, they took pictures of stuff. I even had, because I wanted to get some of the stuff of me. But the guy told me they were destroyed, but I don't think they are. They did write a history, and I distributed to people. I guess GSA had done it, but it was so sanitized. They even have a little museum. But it's not like Barbie Penny's book or anything like that. It's like more of the furniture, the superintendent, the child that they had. you know, a little piece from the chapel. In fact, the old chapel now is being outfitted. It's going to be a Microsoft Innovation Center. But in the, and I say that if anybody's coming to Washington, even though the little museum is tiddly, I would say if that, because the hospital is on a subway line, if they're interested, I would go because the patients do the little tour of the place, of the new building. But the old building, the old architecture, you can still walk around and you can see how they had the huge day rooms, even the outside day rooms they had screened in a place. Because at one time, it was in the 60s, St. Elizabeth had about 6,000 people. The first time I went over there was like in the early 90s, and they had lots of people. And you can cut me off, Lauren, because I know I can rattle on. I remember this when we talked about the new Department of Mental Health, and I would go over there for meetings. They had some of us peers that would go to, of course, we weren't paid, but all the other consultants were paid. And I had never seen that because I had not been there in that particular hospital myself, where they would have lines and lines of people. This is like 94, 95. They'd have lines of people, and these were some of the people that, you know, obviously they had either had the lobotomy or they had been so chemically that, you know, you look at the person, you know how you say, you look at the person's face and there's nobody home. And people
right,
would
that they
just
were, that they've been murdered, that just that they've been killed, tortured, had their
yeah, my dad was like that. And then that was the first time I had heard about the Haldol shuffle, because people would have this kind of walk that now I think they call it akinesia. Is that the word for it, where you make movements? But that's where. And they would have long lines of people. These were huge.
You mean tardive dyskinesia? Dyskinesia?
No. This is where you have like you're making movement, involuntary movement, and the people would have like a kind of a shuffle, and that's
yeah.
what they would call it. They told me that was the Haldol shuffle.
Right.
And not that they were dancing. In other words, this is the way
right.
they move.
Right, because the drugs do that to the body, and so the tardive dyskinesia is an injury that results from the drugs, and it includes involuntary repetitive movement.
And I'm trying to think of my friend. I had I know he's still around. I know a husband and wife, but the husband was born in St. Elizabeth. And I know a lot of those people that were lifers there, most of them are out now. But there were people that people think about the terms of people in the hospital that they didn't have relationships or anything, but they did. There were people that were there for long periods of time still. 20, 30, 40 years. And
right.
And they had what, you could slap me on the wrist by saying, but this is what put my fellow residents at the hospital used to call it, Bush therapy. So even though they had those locked wards, they had things where people go in between, and people did have children, some by other residents of the hospital and some by staff. You know, which is, you know, that was there. But they had the buildings are still there. They haven't been torn down. And on the other side
Sometimes because the women were raped by staff, right? I mean, that's...
Oh, no, I'm not saying it's voluntary because when you're in situations like that, people control, and everybody that's on this line probably, they control everything you have. They control
right.
when you eat. Whether you can go get a cigarette, whether you can go outside. In fact, I just got finished talking to someone on the phone about an hour ago who I dropped a book off at the hospital and I couldn't get in. And the person wanted to pay me for it. And they didn't hardly even want to acknowledge that the person was there, but I knew they were there. And they did call me back and tell me that, you know, thank you very much. I got the book, and I want to make sure that I get money to you for it because I might need something else. I told them not worry about it. But, yeah, it's a very oppressive situation.
Right.
And that's why I say they're not – I don't think they're going to go back to those old institutions. I think the plan is probably – because it takes a long time to build hospitals or refurbish them. I'm afraid to say this, and I hope that I'm wrong. I think that some people's long-range plan is to use military facilities. Because,
well, oh, sure, FEMA. I mean, that's FEMA's plan, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, he does.
I mean, I did say that under my breath. I said, that's FEMA's plan, isn't it? I think the real plan is, and everybody really needs to watch out for, is these friggin' health homes, because this is where it's all going to happen. It's all going to happen in the guise of being in the community where the institution now has followed us and has locked us in our own homes. And so all of these health homes through managed care and Medicaid and all this stuff, this new reorganization of it, this is going to be where the involuntary outpatient commitment happens. And these are going to be the people who wind up ultimately being responsible for carrying it out, I think.
Well, how do you think that's going to do? Because, you know, I looked into that health home because I was trying to figure out a way for that organization to do some, you know, field work, because it seemed like the way they were describing the health home. And, of course, each state had their own health home plan. I know. At least where we were living in D.C., it was like almost...
Right, sure, I'm coming from New York's perspective of the health home and how it's been introduced.
D.C. Was impossible to do it and give any input. It was a closed thing.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these things are happening now. In fact, I think we've gone back in the last 5 to 6 years, we've gone backwards, because at least... 10 years ago, they would give us the courtesy of having us in the room.
Right, I'm almost never welcome in the room anymore. There's maybe one or two people who still will get me in, but for the most part, I'm never in the rooms anymore. But I was close enough to the rooms to get the PowerPoints.
Oh, really? Well, I'm saying that's true now. That's what's happening. You're not welcome in the room because you know too much. Before, you know, they would, you know, it seemed as though that they only wanted people who really didn't know anything. And by the time you were schooled and knew enough to assert yourself, after a while, I'm the same way, you know. But, you know, I managed to find out information anyway. But getting back to the health homes, I see what you're saying, because the health homes are supposed to be able to coordinate care with all these other services. So I guess they would be the ones that would be instigating the involuntary outpatient commitment.
Right, and part of what they're charged with is, in New York anyway, I don't know if this is how it is now, but when I was being involved in however I was being involved, part of what they were doing is that they were responsible, especially for the people who were high, you know, quote unquote, what do they call them in Colorado, frequent flyers or some crap like that, like people who were using whose quote unquote services required a lot of money. So that's where the involuntary outpatient commitment stuff. So very early on, when we started getting presented with us, many of the people who are advocates and activists in New York started saying, wait a second, this is going to be the new involuntary outpatient commitment, and that the Health Homes Act is the tools for them. But, you know, I mean, I don't mean to, like, jump to Murphy, but I'm going to just for a minute even, because I'm reading his, I signed up, I don't know why, I signed up for his e-news, I guess because I like, you know, on a regular basis having my blood pressure be externally skyrocketed just for the hell of it to see if I survive. And, so
they're going to come and get you. You want to know when?
I'll tell you, this man has some freaking audacity, you know, just the so there's an article in it called Murphy Makes Major Announcement During National Suicide Prevention Week, which I know is like such a rough issue for so many of us right now and always, and people have a lot of high emotions about it and a lot of, you know, and it's a reality. It's just part of life. Anyway, this guy, after throwing out all of these statistics, where who knows where the hell he gets them from, and, you know, just so you get, so you understand, this year, 9.3 million adults will have serious thoughts of suicide. 9.3 million. Where do you get a statistic like that? 2.7 million will make suicide plans. 1.3 million will attempt suicide, and nearly 40,000 will die by suicide. So, I mean, and he does bring up the suicide that's the rate at which veterans are taking their own lives, which is something that should concern every single person so deeply. Any of this should. But where do you get a statistic like 9.3 million adults will have serious thoughts of suicide? Are there 9.3 million adults in the world? Is that where you get
I don't know where he's getting it from, but he might be getting it through. I can't remember the name of it. It's PRQ. It's something with a name, and it's got RQ in it. When people go to the doctor now, they have this little questionnaire that they ask you.
Oh, you mean the Pfizer product, the PRQ-10 or 9 or whatever it is? It's a Pfizer product. That's what that is. Oh, then those numbers are unrealistic, because I've used that thing so many times in class and filled it out so that they can see that it tells you to call 911 if you say that you feel like you'd be better off.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I agree with 100%. You asked where they're getting from. I'm guessing that might be the place, because I'm just saying, I know just anecdotally, because for a short period of time, for 3 or 4 years, I was involved in data collection. And so that's possibly one of the places that he could get it from. And the thing about it is, every time the person goes to the doctor, they have that. So the question, what happens, they don't have enough people in the room to question them. So the first question is asked, is that an unduplicated count? So if a clinic or a doctor or whatever else, if they have 400 patients and they each time they come, they have that questionnaire, you know, that right. could be an unduplicated count, and he could be making, you know, a true statement. And in some places they use that to measure things, just like they use the MISA. I don't think that would cost, because that's a sample that they use, but that might be where they're getting it from.
Right.
That kind of, so it would have to be for something. It would have to be something that's so widely used, and he could. And you know, Murphy is not above skewing figures and information.
No,
so,
not at all. Well, that's part of the point. But that wasn't even really. That's one of like three things in this thing that had me shooting off of. You know, you put quotes around it. I mean, the thing that makes me like, you know, like what are you talking about? Is because there are quotes around it as if it's something he said, which somehow legitimizes it because it's quoted in the article that comes from him. Like, you know what I mean? He's giving himself quotes in his own article as if to kind of legitimize what it is that it's saying, but doesn't actually give the resources, the references of where he's getting it from. But then there's this other big thing around the issue that – so – speaking on his Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, Murphy urged support of his legislation to, among other things, expand research at the National Institute of Mental Health to, quote, enhance our understanding of suicide and advance evidence-based approaches to prevention that are not solely centered around raising awareness. Murphy announced in his speech from the House floor that is, he is convening a special energy and commerce panel next week in his oversight and investigation subcommittee entitled Suicide Prevention and Treatment, Helping Loved Ones in Mental Health Crisis. Then proceeds to just throw in the final towel and say, this summer the nation was shocked and heartbroken and at the news of celebrated actor Robin Williams' death by suicide. Perhaps the greatest gift Robin Williams has left us, Murphy's E! News says, is to remind the nation that suicide remains a public health crisis, said Murphy.
Well, you know, it depends on what the, you know, it's a, I'm not going to mince words. I think it's a horrible thing when anyone leaves this earth. You know, it's a sad thing for the family members and the people that cared about it. But to make a person's death or those amount of people, I think what they're saying is suicide is the number two reason for death among young people. But, you know, what are the causes of that? And,
well,
I
nowhere in here are the SSRIs mentioned. But just the way that they're using, just for the optics of it, forget all the issues, forget the reality of what's going on, forget whether or not this is a good or a bad thing. When they are trying to get people to follow along and to allow things to happen by the government's hand in creation of these kinds of things, now the title is Helping Loved Ones in Mental Health Crisis, right? And they draw on Robin Williams. When they're trying to get people to, because either way, people are getting forced into this, right? The end result is still forced psychiatry. But when they're trying to do it from a perspective of violence, they'll throw some irrelevant factor in as some previous heinous crime, very often that was not committed by somebody who had a psychiatric label, and call it helping families in mental health crisis. You know what I mean?
The guy in the Newtown, somebody brought this in a discussion on Facebook. The guy in Newtown, the young man, Adam Lanza, he had psychiatric treatment. He probably had the best because his dad was a vice president of a Fortune 500 company. It's just like my friend Patrick Kennedy. I say my friend, he's not really my friend. But I'm saying Patrick Kennedy and John Stanley from the Stanley
Adam
Foundation.
Adam Lanza, we must not be talking about the same person because Adam Lanza, to the best of my knowledge, was not diagnosed with a strictly psychiatric issue.
He was diagnosed with autism, supposedly, but
which is in the DSM, but is not right.
But it has been allegedly, because like I said, we don't have access, is that he has been seeing, he had been getting all kinds of psychiatric help. That's supposedly alleged, and that has not come out. Just like the guy in Colorado who killed the people in the movie theater, his records are sealed. So you don't know what I'm saying is many of these people, and you brought this up on past shows, it's not that they weren't in treatment. They were getting treatment. Robin Williams, I'm quite sure access was not a problem for him. Now, out there in Hollywood, I'm quite sure he had a psychiatrist. He probably had the availability of the best drugs that there were.
I think to me it's not really, I guess this is going in a way that I hadn't anticipated, but to me the main point is the way that they're dragging this stuff out based on social affection or fear. And that they are using social affection or fear to any particular person or group as a way to leverage pushing forth his bill. The optics of what he's doing, the manipulated way in which he's going about trying to override the community, the public, the United States in this perpetrated fraud that he is pushing forth, and that there is.
But he's doing it two ways, and you have to realize it was both ways. Because what happened is they're like a boxer that got punched up. I'm waiting for them to come out and say something about this guy that supposedly killed his five children in Alabama or Mississippi. But I guess it's quite clear that he was high on, you know, synthetic marijuana. But they would try, what they do is they go back into the person's background, and, you know, he had sought some psychological help. And this is the one of the things that people don't understand is by doing things like what's in Murphy, it's going to really drive people who really could be helped by psychologists or psychiatrists or therapists who was trained properly, could be helped. It's going to drive them not to go to get any help. Because,
well, yeah, I mean, yeah, but that's that. I really reject that argument because it conveys. I mean, I don't reject it in theory. I'm sure that happens. I'm not rejecting that happens, but it also
it
pushes the idea that somebody could get help from in terms of this kind of thing. And Yvonne, I just want to keep you there, but 970, your line is open and has been open for a while. So at any point you want
to
jump in.
I was going to try to interrupt because I appreciate the enthusiasm, and you. The reason why I pressed one was you mentioned numbers like 9.3 million. Okay, now why would you come up with 9.3? I understand that. But, Lauren, do you think it's more or less than that?
Well, I mean, I just can't see how any thinking being hasn't at some point seriously contemplated.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I mean. 9.3 million people? Are you kidding? If you're going to give a number, make it half. I mean, half the people in the world have not thought of it, but I think it's one of the basic human feelings, just as elation, suffering, horror. I don't think, and not everybody attempts suicide. But
right, because they broke it out. That first it was have serious thoughts, then we'll make plans, then we'll attempt, and then how many actually...
When you make these things abnormal or the exception to the rule instead of making them an everyday experience. It's like saying only 9.3 people ever are happy at the time of their death. I mean, it's arbitrary and ridiculous. Suicide or thoughts of death is as natural and as common as thoughts of let's get high, let's rejoice, I feel depressed. People who say, oh, they're depressed, you know, assume that feeling alone is a bad thing. Everybody at one time in their life would have a depressive feeling, thought, or action. I mean, it's a part of the human experience. It's a part of being alive. All those are just part of life. I read something on Facebook. I read several things on Facebook. One was, though, that this particular person blamed they're compulsively eating or they're continually to overeat ice cream on their bipolar disorder. And if she was in front of me, I would have said something different, but I did respond. But when you blame a so-called disease for a common everyday experience, now you tell me how that in this world that there isn't anyone that could totally relate to the fact that at times they have overeaten ice cream, and maybe even more than they'd like to, okay? But to blame that on your bipolar disorder, if you truly have a bipolar disorder, and part of my response is, if you're overeating ice cream, it's more likely due to a side effect of the so-called medications you're on that increase your appetite.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about, I'm not saying, will or self-control.
It could be a whole host of things. But the bottom line is that as humans, we have access to seven main emotions. One of them can be either positive or negative, and one of them is positive, and the other five are negative. So to suggest that, you know, I mean, happiness is a gift. Happiness is fleeting. Happiness is not, and if you were happy all the time, how the hell would you know it? Like, you would have nothing to compare to. There would be no, and they make, and this is, I think, why Carl Jung was so outcasted, because he talked about the darkness in people, and that to really be able to help somebody else, you need to know the darkness in yourself and to be able to feel comfortable with that in the same way. And so this was this image that you're not supposed to have these, you know, or that these, that if you're having these kinds of thoughts, that there's something wrong with you. I mean, you know, and obviously I'm never advocating anyone deciding to take their life. I think that that is such a loss of freedom and potential and possibility. And I ask anybody who's contemplating I just feel I need to say this, to really, to try to find in yourself that you're needed and that you're necessary and that there's purpose for you, even if you may not know what that purpose is at the moment, and that it comes. But to say that you how could you be a thinking being and not have that as a potential thought?
Well, and the thing is it's implied or it's socially assumed that if a person does more than just think suicide, I mean, if anyone ever contemplated, you know, there's a difference between feeling like I want out of this world, I want to die, I don't want this anymore, and then there's another step where you anticipate, plan, and take steps towards a suicide plan. But that in itself is not a mental illness.
Right.
It does not classify you, even in the DSM. If you attempt suicide, you want suicide, you're thinking about suicide, it doesn't automatically get you a mental health diagnosis.
Well,
and
the public doesn't know that, however.
That's why people don't get help, because they don't want to be labeled as crazy or mentally ill. Being suicide is as common and as an expected feeling as happiness, devastation, grieving, bitterness, anger. These are all emotions everybody feels. Now, not everybody, will contemplate, plan, or attempt suicide, but there is also people who in anger, all right, road rage, rape, all these things, crimes, they all were committed with the extreme emotion, okay? They aren't mentally ill either. Now, their behavior is wrong and they need to be corrected or punished or, those people, you don't want a person who's prone to road rage or rape on the street to hurt other people, but it's not a mental illness, and it is in a person's control. And I just because a person's under stress or is having a bad time doesn't excuse behavior that, or, you know, something that you did that is wrong. Okay? So if a person who is has a mental health diagnosis, if a person has a mental health diagnosis, for whatever reason, whether it be their medications causing them to act in a criminal way, or they act in a criminal way for any other reason, they should always face the consequences of their criminal act. Often people with mental health issues will rather go to jail than into if they had a choice, they wouldn't want to go into a forensic unit in a psych hospital. Give me jail. Give me prison, you know. And I personally don't see the difference, because if you're in prison, if they want you on psych meds, it'll be forced. So as far as I'm concerned, it's the making a mental illness or having a mental health diagnosis, making that the exception and not the rule. I mean, these are all everyday common. Why do you think the increase of mental illness diagnosis, why do you think DSM-5 is what? Unbelievably larger than the original?
Oh, hundreds. Expanded.
Yeah.
70 to 90% easily of the population diagnosable, assigned with this fraudulent,
right.
with this fraudulent
because
stuff. I mean, and he even makes specific. He even makes specific. I mean, they are not saying 9.3 quote unquote mentally ill people. They are saying 9.3 million adults. And then the only place of where they say is that they then take it all the way down, and Murphy says, quote, families of those with serious mental illness are already aware that there is a problem. Unfortunately, a small percentage of those with serious mental illness, Murphy says, are not aware they have a problem, but everybody is also painfully aware they cannot get help when someone is in a mental health crisis. And so, you know, they can't make such a statement that it's only people who have psychiatric histories or whatever who have
been
assigned.
Well, let's face it, if we're approximately between 250 to 300 million people in this country, you're telling me only 9.3, or just rounded off to 10 million people are diagnosable under the DSM-5, 4, 3, or 2? You have got to be out of your mind.
But after Murphy, suicide, what you learned?
That's not even about, and I don't mean to talk this lightly about this, but that's not even about attempting suicide. That's about just or making a plan about suicide. That's just, they say that it's 9.3 million will have serious thoughts. They will say 9.3 have serious thoughts, 2.7 will make a plan, and 1.3 will attempt, and nearly 40,000 will die. And
well,
so...
the reason why I think that this probably higher than that, but what I'm saying is the same thing that Sue is saying, that no, these are normal, that people from time to time feel hopeless. It might flash to their mind that they might be better off if they're dead. And on the survey or something, they might answer that way. But I think that the larger scope, and the reason why the public needs to know this, the larger scope is to make it so, in combination with the DSM-5, I really don't believe it's a conspiracy, that it can be that anybody could be picked up. And, you know, once, if we're not successful in beating back Murphy, there's going to be another, like, Mental Health Act or something that's passed. And so it will be so that they can just – these things don't happen just like, you know, one thing at a time. They happen in small increments. You know, this is the same thing that happened in Germany. First they started off working with people who were mentally – developmentally delayed. Then mentally ill. Then they moved on to and other –
Right. I mean, and they are coming after us. I mean, people need to just understand or accept, because they didn't listen for all these years, that people were trying to tell them that this is what was happening. But now the language that's being used is a quote-unquote behavioral health. So you don't even need a quote-unquote illness. All you need is behavior.
And
under the Affordable Care Act, they pushed it in that there's going to be screenings about sexual behavior, drug use, alcohol use, driving practices, sleeping habits, whatever, because behavior is quote-unquote observable. And so they got us all, and now it's a quote-unquote behavioral health system.
But the most people don't, there's 26 states, or it might be 27, I might be off, that don't even have ACA, because Murphy is against having affordable health care. So once a person is adjudicated involuntary outpatient commitment, you know, if you have all these, you have the potential because of DSM-5 is so huge now, and you convince people. See, the thing about it, they're doing a propaganda piece with the public. to convince them that there's this massive plague. That's the purpose of doing these numbers, is to convince the public that there's a plague. There was a rerun last night on CBS with several little clips about. I saw it on the internet because I didn't want to watch. I've sworn off CBS 60 Minutes, and someone brought it to my attention. And what the person who's the lead reporter or announcer in 60 Minutes kept saying was that there's justifiable fear, and that's what happens every time they have a story like this. Something heinous happens. They regurgitate and bring these stuff out, which were talking points directly from TAC, have a whole bunch of mothers that are around that are saying, well, you know, we took our son or daughter to the hospital and they let him out. But the reporter didn't ask the follow-up question is, what did they want to have happen? Now, the inference to that is, my 9-year-old child went to the hospital. They kept us for a few days, and a reporter announced that they stabilized the person. They let them go. Well, the inference is maybe they shouldn't have let them go. That they should keep them. They're conditioning people to feel that there's justifiable fear, even for children, for adults. There's justifiable fear. I mean, they ran the deeds interview, says, oh, my, out of nowhere, my son just attacked me with a knife. You know, didn't say, you know, I was trying to tell him he's going to, you know, go to a psychiatric facility the night before, but out of nowhere. So they are playing this, that there's a plague across the land. That's why all these numbers and the depressing reporters don't challenge it. They try to paint the fact. This is the same thing they did in the 1920s and 30s. Thing they did it for 300 or 400 years with people that know Jewish history in Europe. But they try to demonize people to make like that there's a danger, that people are dangerous, and therefore you could suspend normal constitutional rights. We have a woman here in the suburb in Montgomery County. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia. She had 2 children, and she disappeared with the 2 children. They picked her up. She says the children are safe. They now say they believe the children are dead, but they're holding her because she has a psychiatric diagnosis. I think they charged her with child neglect without bail. So when you do this, you can make it so you don't have to abide by normal. I don't like mm-hmm. the word normal. Bail and process. So they're just like the woman in California who they held her for a week. Their family couldn't talk to her. So if you have all these people that you have screened and you got someone on record that got a mental health diagnosis, for any reason you pick them up, in normal circumstances you pick somebody up, you got to charge them with a crime or let them go. But this is what this is about. This is not about really, I think it's bigger than just coming after mentally ill people, because they made it so they can go after anybody. And that's why other people need to be, and they're not enough. I know we're upset, but there are not enough people upset about this because they don't realize the normal judicial process and your legal rights can be suspended just simply because you happen to have a label. And that might not be so onerous. It might mean that you went to get some grief counseling or something.
Well, and you got to understand, Yvonne, it's not the quote-unquote average Joe citizen wants people who have mental health diagnoses to be restricted and controlled and kept safe from ordinary people so they don't shoot up theaters and they don't disturb them when they go shopping. Or, you know, in society, if a person has been diagnosed, whether it's the fact that these diagnoses are fraud doesn't concern them. The average Joe or the average person in society does not see that psychiatry is either a fraud or even should be questioned. My family, who doesn't even know me, you're right, assumed behaviors as strange that if they would know me, would seem normal, okay? But instead of asking me, instead of inquiring, oh, why do you do that in a certain way, they assumed because it was different from what they do on a regular basis, I was exhibiting mental health issues. And my behavior was simply because I haven't had a car for 25 years. And I got into a habit that every time I went to the store, I did certain things. Certain things always. And so, hence, certain things were always accumulated. And for you, it may seem unusual that that would be the case. But when you don't have a car, sometimes...
I know, but I don't have a car. And
right.
That wasn't
so,
quite
but your behavior is questioned because, you know, my brothers and sisters can get in the car and go and get whatever they want at any time because they are not restricted by not having gas money or that they have a car in itself.
But you bring
no,
up a valuable
you know,
thing. You have to get the lens that the person is looking at because it's just like people like Patrick Kennedy and Stanley, they come from a privilege. And I can understand
some of
them.
Struggle. Patrick Kennedy has the audacity to call his book A Common Struggle. Sorry, go ahead. His upcoming book.
Yeah. I was looking at a clip on his website. I went to the website yesterday for the first time, and he recounted like about 5 or 6 times where he was high as a kite doing different stuff. And I'll send it to you, Lauren, so you can look at it. He was being interviewed by someone from Canada. You may have seen it. And so some of these people, they have had where they've gotten off. They feel as though they need the law to step in because they've had the money. That every time they were over medicated, a lot of these people have I call it drug induced mental illness. And
absolutely,
what,
Eva.
Well,
absolutely.
I don't know about that language.
Trouble, somebody bailed them out. They didn't, in other words, I would not have the things that have...
That's otherwise known as white skin privilege, right?
Yes, they have white skin privilege. They have not only white skin privilege, because people...
And green privilege.
They had rich white privilege.
Right.
In other words, where they say, aha, that's so-and-so's son. You know, we have a thing in D.C. we say... Well, they used to say, I think they still say, they said, if you're black, you go to jail, the police pick you up. If you're white, then you get a ride home.
Oh,
but,
I've said
you know,
many a times, if I wasn't mm-hmm. a 5'2" white woman, I would not be able to, I would not have been able to do almost anything I've done in my life. And there were plenty of times that my parents worked 10,000 times harder than they had to bail my ass out. But the truth of the matter is, even especially with activism or anything like that, I would not be able to, if I was a 6'5" man of color, I would not be able to be getting into the places I'm getting into and to getting video of things
yep.
I'm able to get. It absolutely, and common struggle my ass.
Your
sorry,
family have privilege, and I'm not talking about just, it goes beyond just that, because if you're a Kennedy or a Stanley, you're a person with millions of dollars, and everybody knows your name, as they say,
right.
It's different for you. If you're a movie star,
right.
and things happen, it's different for you. You don't encounter the same. You may have the same feelings of hopelessness or whatever else. Every addict can identify with what some of the things another addict's gone through, but the availability of stuff. So, of course, you feel as you know you got lots of chances, 4 or 5 chances to do this, you know. But you got, you know, it's different. It's not the same. And the thing about it is, you won't have the same due process. You'll get the public defender, or I'll get the public defender, or either your parents have to, you know, kind of mortgage their home if they're so predisposed. And like I said, these things are ripe for, even as it is now, without any laws being passed, if you get picked up for something and they take you to a psychiatric facility, they can hold you for, well, you said 72 hours, but a lot of places is longer than that. And
especially if you get there like on a Friday at 5:03 p.m.
It's at least 72 hours. It's not only 72 hours, like you said, on a weekend. And then I tell you, if the doctor doesn't want to release you, there's another.
There's another forever. They just make a determination that you need to be institutionalized. Done. That's it. I mean,
they give you another week.
Is like
even bother take you down before the judge. Man, they want to do it. But make it fast track. They can do it by video.
Right.
You know,
I just want to tell us psychiatry, right? They can, and then they can buy video, make sure that you swallow the pill, and if not, have the goon standing behind you take you down. I just want to interject for a second here, and please stay on the line, Yvonne and Maria, and I just want to make sure there are a couple of people who are online, so if you want to talk at any point, be sure to press 1 or star 1. And if you want to call in, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. It is an open lines, anything goes show. So if you want to call, 267-521-0167.
Lauren, did you hear anything of what happened with John in Ohio? Didn't he have his court date?
I am unaware of exactly what is going on at this point, but I know that it is going on. And I think that there are ways to get in touch with him, and I don't have the number at my hands of where he's at, but I can find it and
I think I lost it, but then found his number. But I don't want to call that institution if he's not in there. Because it didn't have a September 12th date.
Right. It's my understanding that it's ongoing. And when I have some information that I can talk about, I will.
John, if you're listening, I'm still praying for you.
And I think we're all wanting to do exactly what the right thing to assist. I think that is trying to figure out what is the right thing to do and then how to do it in order to be most helpful. But yeah, a lot of support.
Unsafe housing or something. We may have to have some other kind of assistance for people, and I hope that we don't. And I hope that people really realize how what it's like today, without even any laws changing, how dangerous it is. I mean, I've asked people to write on the blog other than Mind Freedom, on the blog that I have, and I've seen people say, well, what can you do? And I said, well, I'm asking people to tell their positive stories of recovery, and you got people that are seem like now they've gone in the woodwork. I notice even online, you know, people in private groups, they sometimes reluctant. You're not Lauren, but they're reluctant to have things on their wall. I said, well, what good is it if you have a small group of you, and all you do is all day you sit down and you talk like we're talking, but you don't bring other people along. So there is some fear out there, and there's another subset of people. I shouldn't say a subset, a huge amount of people. Some of them are labeled people, too, who really don't, they really haven't caught on that that some of these things are going to expand. And it's going to be, if you don't play careful. And I just wanted to say that tomorrow, September 16th, there will be a day of online action opposing the Murphy bill. Congressman Murphy will be speaking at the Discovery to Recovery, a pathway to Health Minds Conference in Washington, D.C. And during this time, some people they're asking people with a Twitter or Facebook account to post messages supporting Sam for Tammy and Heal Recovery. And I have put it on my Facebook page and on Lauren's as well. And you can use one or more of these hashtags to include in the conversation. Hashtag DiscoverDC, hashtag Tammy Matters to Me. That's the number 2ME. Hashtag SAMHSA Matters, hashtag Peer Not Fear, and hashtag Peer Not
SAMHSA Matters. Who's behind this? The Samson Matters.
Well, this is just somebody.
Sorry. I think that we should oppose. I think that we should oppose any which way we should oppose this bill. That it should be opposed. It should be opposed up and down, left and right, every which way. But I just
they're not coerced, and this someone posted this from Philadelphia. I was just sharing it.
Sam's the Matters.
Oh, they're still bringing up the Robin Williams stuff.
I'm sorry, but if SAMHSA funding wasn't at threat of being fucking, I'm really bad tonight. If SAMHSA funding wasn't in threat of being taken away, would there be a hashtag called hashtag SAMHSA Matters?
Well, I don't think this is coming from SAMHSA people. You have to remember this. You had a backstroke. A lot of people are in the SAMHSA pocket.
Do you think that there would be allowable activism online if SAMHSA funding wasn't part of what was being activated around?
It's muted. I would think that, I don't think that either people are not taking it serious, because I talked some months ago when I did a webinar with a person who had millions and millions of dollars in suburban Maryland contract, and they didn't seem like they thought that SAMHSA was any kind of threat. I think people, they're underestimating it, because the people, the bedfellows of Mercy, really despise SAMHSA and really want money to go to NIMH. And I think if they have an overlord,
right? But I just mean like. Oh, I don't know, Yvonne, but SAMHSA's been shutting us down for 25 years. A movement perspective, I understand they fund all of the pure run stuff, but that's what I mean. Like, if their funding was not being directly attacked, people who work for any of these peer-run organizations would not be able to be doing this level of lobbying and involvement.
Have already gone to the other side. You didn't realize a lot of these peer programs now have been medicalized.
So SAMHSA Matters. SAMHSA Matters for what? Getting people to become indoctrinated into psychiatry?
I understand that. I'm not going to fight on that, because we're probably a little more closer to agreeing on that. But I do think the other thing is about courage, because what happens is I was at a meeting about 2 years ago, and wherein Yvonne Minashak said this. He said that the block grant money, that this was pre-Merck. He was saying in a few years it won't be there. That you got to get in there and talk to the managed care company.
But there have been so many of us that have been so okay about that for so long. I want to keep on going, but the phones are lighting up. So I want to bring in area code 330 and 718. I'll bring you in just a moment. 330, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, it's Sharon. How you doing?
I'm good, Sharon. Thanks. How are you?
You're good.
On the air.
Great. I just want to go back to John Rohr for a second.
Thanks.
Because someone was asking about him, and
yes,
you're
Maria.
Correct. I am in Ohio, and I am with John, and his case is ongoing. So as a result of his case being ongoing, I'm not going to talk about a lot of the details tonight with regard to what has happened and what is happening in his case. But I do just want to let folks know that I have been with John, and I have seen everything that has happened in his case, and he's doing great. He's holding up way better than I would in his position. And he is still at the Appalachian Behavioral Health facility at the same number, and I'm sure he would appreciate support at this point. And His case is continued until a week from this Thursday. We're hoping to have a decision a week from this Thursday. And at that point, I would be able to, you know, speak a lot more freely about the events of his case. So that's where we are with John Rohr. He's doing great. He's still in the same place, and we're hoping to wrap up a week from Thursday.
Well, thank you for calling in with that update, and all the support in the world, and anything that you know, any way that is most helpful, and that's always the thing of what's going to help.
Right.
You know, that we don't want that, but.
And I think John,
so important.
I think John would appreciate calls at this point. You know, I think he'd appreciate support.
I have to find his number again. Do you have it more readily available?
I do not have it in front of me, unfortunately.
I will go through and find it. I know I have it, and so I will make it hopefully within the next 50 minutes I'll be able to find it. So I will let people know.
And I'm going to look for it, too.
Okay, great. So I'm just wondering in terms of I was just on Twitter. I was trying to get on Twitter, trying to find who's behind this Town Samson Matters thing. But there's an online activism thing going on tomorrow opposing the Murphy Bill, right? That's what I'm essentially getting, right?
It's supposed to be to support these other things. And the PAMI is one of the big things. That was just one of the three hashtags. And I think I posted it on your thing. In fact, I posted rather quickly, and then someone asked me, was it all there or whatever, and I sent a message to the person who posted originally to see if it's, you know, the way they said it seemed as though it was all day, but usually when you do these kind of Twitter storms, they're done within an hour, and I was trying to find in fact, I would go to the place where Murphy is if I needed someone else to go with me. Because I don't know if I could be able to contain myself being in his presence. But
hear that? That's in D.C. on the 18th, right? If anybody can get to D.C. to meet Yvonne to go to the helping loved ones in mental health crisis meeting that Murphy is putting together.
Free of recovery, a pathway to healthy minds on September 16th. Now, they say Washington, D.C., and I was trying to Google to see where it's being held. But sometimes when they say Washington, D.C., they really mean Rockville or somewhere like that. Because
where the actual meeting is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have John's number.
Oh, great. Thanks, Sharon.
And I'll also post it on my Facebook in a little bit. It is 740-594-5000, and you just go through the operator and ask for John. And in the evening from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., they have kind of a free recreation period, and I find that's the best time to get a call through to John.
But you're thinking this will be over within another week?
I'm sorry?
You're thinking this might be over with for him in another week?
We expect a decision from the judge a week from this Thursday, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I understand why you can't talk about it right now, but as many people around the country that, you know, in this situation and and just as I said, people don't realize that sometimes that, you know, it's a shame when people talk about, you know, that the mentally ill are being, mentally illness is being criminalized and people in jail. But it's being criminalized because people are using that as a way not to do due process for people.
Yeah. quote unquote, just be assigned.
And I think that's really interesting, and I think that it is a big issue. It's much bigger than John Rohr. It's happening to a lot of people and a lot of activists, and especially some of the more mainstream organizations. They don't want to touch the not guilty by reason of insanity, the people who are kind of caught in that dynamic, because it's not sympathetic. You know, they're
right.
not Justina Peltier, and they're not Isaiah Ryder. And I think it's really important that those folks have a voice. And I think that when this case concludes, let you guys know there's been a lot of interesting stuff going on in this case and stuff that's relevant to our movement as a whole. I think, Lauren, it may be, you know, it may be useful and it may be interesting to just, you know, get everybody who's been involved in that process on the line and do a whole show. And get
starting
John,
with John, yeah.
Starting with John, yeah.
Starting with
exactly.
John, yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that there are so many, you know, there's so much subjectivity as to anything that can fall under quote unquote not guilty by reason of insanity, and people immediately jump to the worst of the worst situations and don't realize that there's really a whole range of things that people wind up getting in this loop for, not understanding that they may never, ever get out. Even if under whatever circumstance, even if the most heinous thing happened, and people don't like talking about this, and this makes people very uncomfortable, but even if it was the most heinous of heinous things, human rights means human rights for all. And just because somebody may have done something doesn't mean that they get to be retaliated against in this way forever, particularly with the drugging. And I think that's one of the reasons why really bringing across that this is like torture and that this is torture for many people who are being forced, that their perspective of it is torture. Getting thrown down on the floor and shot up with drugs is torture. Whether you've done something bad previous in your life or not, it's torture. And we don't torture people who are considered, quote-unquote, terrorists. And so we should not be torturing people who are considered, quote-unquote, ill. it just is really problematic for me. And I know it's I think doing even just a series of shows on the multiple issues that all of this creates and brings like a storm around would be really important to educate people about what the realities are.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
I wanted to ask Sharon, it seems like there's a undertone of I'm trying to use the right word, are things pessimistic in John's case? That I don't know if it's because you're a couple hours ahead of me, or it just sounds like it's not, you're not being optimistic about what's going on.
You know, there's more testimony that's going to be given a week from Thursday, and I'm just really not able to draw an opinion until I hear what else is going to be said in the case.
Well, will you be seeing John person to person soon?
Yes, I'll be seeing John again next Thursday at the conclusion of his case.
Will you give him a hug for me? I probably will call him again, but I know what it's like to be in a hospital, even if you have support. In the middle of the night, it's not a friendly place, and it's not even just what you are going through. You know, it's the noises around you, the threat of the staff deciding that they're going to be hard on you, and, you know, things that are tolerated by under any other circumstances are punished and retaliated for in a hospital. So to have to spend a long-term time in there, I really ache for John, because people should not have to be under those conditions, whether or not they're considered mentally ill or not. And I strongly believe that not only is psychiatry a fraud, that I know when I went ahead and took the doctor's recommended medications, I can clearly see that while the medications made the experience worse, whether or not I was willing to take the medicine or not, I never got any relief from medicine. It was just another struggle, another thing to encounter. I never had peace until I was off. So I don't know if he even wants to be off, but I know he doesn't want to be confined. And I, you're my thoughts every day, and best wishes and tight hugs.
This is Sue, right?
This is Maria who is just speaking.
Maria, okay, yes, I will definitely give John a hug from you, Maria, mm-hmm. and I know he will appreciate that. And I can appreciate everything you've just said. I am a survivor, and I have been hospitalized, and I appreciate the retaliation,
yeah.
and I appreciate the things that go on that are just absolutely heinous in that setting. And I will convey the hug and your best wishes to John.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And I'd like to invite everybody to stay on, but I also, 718, you've been hanging on for a long time, so your line is open. You're on the air.
Hi, Lauren. This is Celia.
Hi, Celia.
I got to go on a radio show to talk to you.
You've been driving.
How's
up
everybody far? Doing?
Good. How are you?
Okay.
What's going on?
Well, you know, I've been working with Frank Blankenship. For those of you who don't know him, he's a survivor and is with Mind Freedom Florida.
Amazing activist. He's been on the. He's called in several times over time.
Great!
Amazing.
Great.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I've been supporting him. He, and I know, Lauren, you know about this, but he came up. He did a workshop at the Creative Revolution Mind Freedom Conference in July on landing zones. It's sort of like the Underground Railroad to help people
mm-hmm.
escape psychiatry and also forced drugging.
Mm.
So we had sort of, he did a presentation about how many states are doing involuntary commitment. And so where he left it off is having a conference call to see if we can have more people, Mind Freedom members or other people who are interested, to really brainstorm this idea. So there's going to be a conference call on September 27th, 4 to 5 Eastern Standard, and then 1 to 2 Pacific Time. And
sorry, there's a lot of background noise. I just want to make sure that people get it. September 20th, so that's a Saturday.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
It's very hard to come up
Great.
With a date, but we thought that during
Great.
The week
Great.
People
Great.
Are doing
Great.
Stuff, you know, working and things. So I just want to know if anyone is interested, and then I could give your email or send you the information for the call.
I obviously am interested. Do you want do you want to give people an email that they can send email to you discussing that or expressing their interest?
Yeah. So I'm going to give you my Yahoo account because my AOL is just so filled up. It's C.K. Sean, C.K.S.E.A.N. 811 at yahoo.com.
Yahoo. Okay, great. C.K. Sean, C.K.S.E.A.N. 811 at yahoo.com.
Right,
and
I'll
September,
forward him the information. Go ahead.
And September 27th, 2014, from 4 to 5 Eastern, 1 to 2 Pacific,
mm-hmm.
would be the time. And if people want the phone number and such to send you an email, and you will send that on to the person, and then that person
right,
will
and I can even
connect
give
with,
you the
with contact information
with Frank
for the call.
And also, yeah, the
it's,
conference
it's
call number.
It's 811, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
It's CK Sean 811.
Right, at yahoo.com.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So it would be really great if this could happen. He's been really concerned about this and has done a lot of research. And currently there's 45 states that have involuntary commitment. I don't know all them all. It's just 45 states. That's a lot.
I heard that every 50 states have to get involuntary commitment laws.
There's only five that don't have.
Under Murphy,
oh, really?
But not even under Murphy, under the Doc Fix bill.
Oh.
Right, that they put in the incentive to the 8 states that didn't already have laws for, like, I don't know, however many millions of dollars that they put in the incentives for. And then under Murphy, all of the states have then a financial incentive to create laws that are left. I think there's like 5 left or something. So yeah, Frank's concern, I think, is
Connecticut doesn't have it. I don't think they have it. Outpatient commitment.
Yeah, Connecticut doesn't have it. Tennessee doesn't have it. Massachusetts doesn't have it. New Mexico doesn't have it. And I
wait, are you sure about Massachusetts? I thought maybe they did have it.
Massachusetts doesn't have it. But
I thought that they just got it. I thought they just accepted one of those grants to create a program.
Yes, they did. It just went through in Massachusetts.
E2 Massachusetts.
And that's out of the Doc Fix bill. That is the section from the Murphy bill that they snuck out and snuck into the Doc Fix bill. So that's been going on the whole time. And all anybody's doing is scrambling trying to save funding, which is fine, you know, whatever. But the bigger point is that the country is we're closer than we let on. So this landing zones committee will have a conference call on September 27th, 2014, from 4 to 5 Eastern, 4 to 5 p.m. Eastern. If
right.
you would like to be involved with this and want the contact information, it's going to go through several levels of people. It will eventually come back to you from Frank Blackenship. And CK Sean 811 at yahoo.com is the contact information to start that process of getting the phone number, if you're interested.
Lauren, thank you so much. This is a long time coming. Actually, this started with David Oakes and a couple of people. It never got off the ground. And I think it's ready to do something, you know, and really move it forward.
It's a necessity. Unfortunate necessity now because people don't realize that things are happening already. And just you know, and it's very difficult to have because you got 50 different states, territories, and when you think you put out one fire, that's why you have to really have people paying attention to what's happening.
Right, but also people are suffering, and people call Mind Freedom survivors and their family saying, look, my child is being force-treated, what do I do? course, you don't have enough lawyers to help with this. I mean, it's so many different levels that, you know, people are really suffering from involuntary commitment and forced drugging. It's just incredible to me, you know.
Well, should lawyers that then hear this also put their interest there? Well, they should want to be on that call.
Yeah, I you know, I've been, you know, Jim Gottstein has been really involved, but we need others too that are really interested. So if you know of any that are interested in this, that'd be great.
I think we must be doing something. I'm so glad that Frank is doing this.
Yeah, me too.
And I think
and I'm just
really
supporting
practical.
Him. I'm trying to really support Frank and help, you know, with the technical assistance, with the conference call number, and sending it out to the
members.
And
it's another great way for people to get involved. It's online. You don't have to, you know, you'll be communicating either over phone or online. You don't have to leave your house be anywhere specific. And for people who are just even starting out, who have this belief that there should be something like an Underground Railroad, it's a great opportunity to get connected with like-minded people. You know, you don't need to, for anybody who may be listening, you don't need to be been doing this for years in order to get involved. You just need to believe in what it's about.
Right.
You know, that's
right. It's true. It's really true. It's
as a matter of
really
fact,
true.
Like, you're desperately needed. Right?
That's the important piece. Might be better if you haven't been doing it for years.
Right, that's right.
Right,
If you just believe this is what should be and this is how it is, then, and there are so many good people out there doing all kinds of things and connecting, and so if you hear this on the show and you really have never been involved with the quote unquote movement, and you've been, you know, you yourself may have escaped psychiatry, this is a great way to get involved with what's going on and bring your voice.
Yeah, and we do need, you know, the younger people too.
Oh,
I always want to encourage young people to be involved. You know,
hell yeah.
I think that's important too. You know,
Lauren.
They're the ones who would have made me safe landing more than others, too.
I'm sorry, what was that?
And they made me safe landing even more.
Right, they may need the landing even more, right, absolutely. And Maria, were you trying to say something?
Yeah, Lauren, and I if I'm at a turn, you don't have to answer, but it sounds like this is a great thing. But I want to bring up something, and, I mean, I know our ultimate goal is for those who want to be out of this, who no longer want to be controlled by the system or by false psychiatry, but some are going to be lost, some are not going to be able to be reached for whatever reason, whether it is suicide or that their illness has been so drastically hurt by the medications, years, decades of medications that shorten the lives of our cohorts, our friends, our people we want to see come out of the system, when there will be those who are not going to be able to make it, never even get the opportunity to do something like an Underground Railroad. And so many people who are passionate, as we are all on the phone right now, about seeing something done, sometimes can be paralyzed when people who you want more than anything to make it lose the battle. And
absolutely.
I don't want to put a downer on this. But as excited as we are to get something done, if it's enough people, and if it's personal enough, people get tripped up when for those who don't make it. And they lose a little bit of the fight themselves.
Right,
and the
decades of damage that were experienced prior to that somehow get wiped out, and somehow
right.
it becomes
and none of
on us instead of on the larger system.
Right,
and that's a reality, yeah. And I really hear what you're saying, and I appreciate that.
And none of us who are in this movement is personally responsible for another person's recovery or another person's
or choices. The whole point.
Yes,
absolutely.
I mean,
the
you
whole
can't
point is that people can make choices, and that those choices are on the onus of the individual, not on any other person.
The individual has
absolutely.
To do the action themselves. No one can. They can stand alongside. I want to stand alongside my friend who has not yet made it as far as I have. I want to stand along, but in the end, they have to do the work themselves.
True.
And don't take the loss so personal that it paralyzes you. I see a friend going through that right now, and I ache for her because I can do nothing but say, here's my hand, I'm ready to help. But if she doesn't take it, I can't do anything. But so that happens anywhere along this process, whether
well, it's
we're
a continuum, and it's a continuous circle because that's every interaction. But certainly, I mean, there have been many of us who have been there. But I think the and who carry the responsibility. I lost a friend that to this day I carry a piece of that responsibility. I know, legitimately, I have no responsibility for it, but I carry a piece, and I don't see how any human couldn't carry a piece. And I've worked very hard over the years to turn it into a celebration of what was and a final decision that this person made. But at the beginning, it was difficult. But I think the thing that's exciting about talking about a landing zone for people, about people who are trying to escape psychiatry, is that even before it gets to any individual who's in the process of attempting to escape the forced torture that they're being subjected to, it's a connection of like minds of people who want to do that support and the creation of a support network for us who are doing it. It's another level of creating sustainability, creating network, creating community, and being supportive because obviously, anybody who's been in this situation knows the depth of emotion that is attached to it and all of the other things that come with it, and that very often, most often, it turns out amazingly amazing. And sometimes it's painful, and sometimes that even in the growth process, it's painful. And all I know is that if the people that when I was going through my process or continue to go through my process, I guess I should say, if at any given point any of them would have turned on me and turned me in, it would have been the violation of what it was that I thought it was. And because of that, it comes with this extra responsibility that sometimes winds up really leaving people trying to make sense of life now. You think you've got a sense of it beforehand, and then this tragedy happens of where you lose somebody who you really loved and depended on and had a relationship with and all these other things. And then it's how do I remake sense of this with maintaining the values that I know if it was imposed on me, I would feel so betrayed that somebody would have done that to me.
Lauren, though, I need to say this. We are to stand alongside, we are to help, but we are not saviors.
Well, I don't even see it as help. I see it as, and I think that's one of the big, I don't know, and Celia, you've been around much longer than me.
Yeah.
Calling it help and of moving away from what mutual support was about versus this idea that we were helping people.
I'm not saying a therapist or a doctor helps, but I mean, standing alongside and maybe making sure that person gets food, housing, everything they need. I mean, that kind of help, not anything like a
therapist. Right, I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying is that Yeah. See, I mean, I think that that's where that's the exact kind of help that I don't see as any part of the role of what it is we're talking about. But,
right.
Celia, I'm
you
just
know,
wondering
I
if
just
you
wanna,
would...
I just want to say there are people coming up who have sought me out and others who say, hey, I want to learn everything about activism and human rights. You know, because they have decided they're so sick and tired of the system and the paternalism and everything else that they want something different, and they're willing to learn from other people. I see myself sometimes as a mentor, you know, just telling them about, you know, the Judy Chamberlains, the David Oakes, and Leonard Boyd Frank and everybody else. Like, look them up, read about them, or, you know,
I see you as
letting them
too.
Know who these people were as an education, and then also talking just in support, a regular conversation about all these things where, you know, Lauren and everybody's discussing, because they don't have a forum where they can discuss it. They really don't. And that's hurting them and killing them inside. It takes a piece away from you when you're not able to really be who you are. Talk about human rights violations and how you're feeling. It's difficult. It's going through another trauma, you know, using that word. But I find it refreshing. I'm glad that people are saying, hey, I want a different way. Please show me. Please give me information. Please network with me with people. Which I do all the time, you know.
Right.
And that's what I see my role is. Not really helping people get food and shelter and all of that. That they can do that themselves. They're advocates themselves.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can just give them the information.
Celia, I'm wondering if you would just tell people from your position at Mind Freedom, just a little, if you would, just a little bit about, and David, all good energy and support. David, if you're out there listening or anybody's talking with you, I'll send you a message myself later. The work that Mind Freedom did, and of course the Mind Freedom radio show, I mean, that's,
oh,
you know.
Oh, my God,
like,
well,
that
I'm
was,
glad you're doing it now.
It was fundamental. Now. It was the way that you got information from people, and so, you
yeah,
know, homage
I mean,
to David, this is... On so many
yeah,
levels.
I give homage to David. I mean, I just sometimes I just get so teary with him. He's just a special human being. But he was a true and still is human rights activist. And he's helped so many people, taking cases with people getting forced electroshock in the community, like the Ray Sanford case.
Right.
Elizabeth Stone, I think that's her name. Just incredible amount of really saying, look, he gave his life to activism. He could have been doing something else. And he hadn't been making a lot of money at all and not taking any government money.
Right.
To really, so we
or
can have our own
money.
Voice.
Or
industry,
money.
Right.
Right.
I forget
right.
the terms, yeah. Industry money
yeah.
at all. You know, it's really based on donations and membership dues. And, you know, we're all fighting together this thing called, you know, human rights, you know,
right.
and mental health.
And
go ahead.
And no, mindfreedom.org remains such a fabulous source for people. Mind Freedom International's website, mindfreedom.org, if you're not familiar with it, .org, mindfreedom.org. And it is. It's one of the only, or if the only, independent nonprofit organization that you know, gives information to people about alternatives. It's, you know, and so Celia, your role with them at this point is.
Well, I've been, you know, I'm the president of the board, but I've sort of been helping out until we get a director. And we're a small organization of a small board, and, you know, we're grassroots, and we just help people all over the world. I mean, it's very difficult because we don't have any laws that really support us. So we have to go out and say, this is wrong, and we're going to expose it for what it is, you know.
People can donate, too.
on the website, if you don't mind me saying that.
No,
Julia,
I don't mind.
On MindFreedom.
Thank you, Yvonne.
MindFreedom.org. And I say this all the time on Facebook. We should be supporting MindFreedom and NAPA and those other organizations And it's www.mindfreedom.org. And, in fact, if you on the right side, there's a little donate button so you can, you know, donate online. I know, you know.
You can donate whatever you can. You don't have to be a millionaire or, you know, you can just donate whatever you can.
$50 or, you know,
$20. Some people put in $20. $35 or whatever.
Yeah.
December.
Is it Dendron? What is the magazine that comes out of Mind Freedom?
Well, it's the Mind Freedom Journal. But years ago, we had Dendron. That's not in circulation, but there's old copies of that.
I knew it changed. I just wasn't sure what it was.
Oh, yeah, they changed it. Yeah.
And there are so many phenomenal advocates and activists who are involved and who are doing things through Mind Freedom. It's got over 10,000 members, right?
Yes. And
mailing list, active conversation list. There's the, you know, of where people talk. And then there are Mind Freedom affiliates in most states.
Yeah, and we need others. I mean, if people want to become affiliates, it'd be great because then on the local level, people can be fighting some of these horrible legislation and laws and stuff. And supporting each other as they do it, you know?
Right. And then there's, like, Mind Freedom Ireland and Mind Freedom Ghana.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know,
Mind Freedom.
All the people across the ponds and around the world.
Mary Madoc check her out. She's one's a wonderful Mind Freedom Ireland. I just love her. She's really passionate about human rights, you know?
Yeah,
and electroshock, too.
Right. You know, yeah. Celia, maybe one of these days we can try to put together a Mind Freedom show and really spotlight some of the historical work that it's done, but the current things and ways that people could get involved and things
like
that.
Yeah, that would be great, Lauren. Just, you know, let me know. I know you're busy. We're all busy, but we'll figure it out.
Yes. And maybe there's some, you know, seriously, newcomers who want to get, like, involved.
Yeah,
maybe
ways I want
to do
that.
It. You guys also have like an academic list, right?
Yes, academic list. We still have, but I think we need more academic people involved. So if you can help with that too, Lauren, that'd be great.
Absolutely, I think it's
anybody on the call too.
Yeah, there are a lot of really good resources for people. The Mind Freedom Alert, the Mind Freedom Shield.
Right. And this is our way of fighting back because, of course, no one's fighting for us. They're creating the Murphy's Bill and all this other. I mean, it's really sad. I just can't even believe it sometimes. It's happening. But
and this,
I need to say something again. Sorry.
Go ahead.
I'm not sorry, but I just want to make people aware. I myself is relatively new, and it's not that people aren't interested and people aren't willing to be aware, but you've got to remember that a lot of the people you're trying to advocate for, try to help along this process, have spent decades, years and decades in the system and have been told all along, you need this. You need the doctors, you need the drugs, you need the mental health centers, and that a lot of us don't see any way other than using these systems that are ultimately controlling and bringing us down. They don't see a way to survive without them, and that's why what you were talking about earlier, where like an underground railroad to say, yes, we can move you along. We can bring you safe. We can get you informed enough to do what you need to do and not have to be under the control of the system.
Mm-hmm.
But I also tell you, it is the most frightening thing, and it takes a lot of courage, having done so myself recently, to say not only to the people who are always, I mean, it's an implied threat at the very least that at any time if the contact you have with a mental health center system, if they feel that if you are at all in danger, you're committed, okay? The words aren't even necessarily spoken, but that undertone is like a mold in these
right.
places.
And
okay?
That's why we need landing zones.
Yeah.
And that's
and
why we need
just,
to get young people
that
don't in the system already.
As much help and freedom you promise and you can help us along with, this is the most, this took courage and bravery for me to do. And not only that can't just anyone do it. I mean, my hope is that everybody who has been spent any length of time and see that this system truly doesn't work for the chronically, quote-unquote, chronically mentally ill, and if you've been labeled that way, I was hook, line, and sinker when I first went and got help because they promised if I did X, Y, Z, I was going to be helped. And instead, I was brought into a deeper and deeper despair. And it took me more than 20 years to say, okay, I'm getting out before I die. And it's not necessarily suicide, but the system itself kills its people.
Right.
It slowly makes us deteriorate, even if it's not just the mind, it's the body. I mean, we get so acute, we are taught how to survive life, not live life. And I don't want to spend the rest of my life surviving. I want to just spend the rest of my life enjoying the things that we were all meant to enjoy in the first place, whether it be your puppy or a good meal or not worrying about where you're going to get the rent. These are all privileges that anyone who can maintain a job may have an easier time. But basically, I was forced to go on disability. I had no choice. It was all done for me, and I got it in 1 month. There was really no other opportunity for me at the time. Hence, 20 years later, I've been declared unemployable. So I don't know if I'll ever be employed again, but I do know I am going to truly live life in a manner that I have never done before because I know I don't have to be in the system, but it is the hardest thing after decades to do. I just needed to say that. Thank you.
Good for you, Maria.
Yeah. And it is the hardest thing, and it remains the hardest thing. Day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out. I mean, the same as, you know, you can have that thought of, at any given moment, I could just, be done and check out. You can also have that thought of, at any given moment, I guess I could just go check myself in. You know what I mean? Like, to every day, to reject the notion that that is the answer, that takes work, too. And I think that, in really creating some sustainable ideas of landing zones for people who have already made the choice to get out, right, who maybe not who are in the process of deciding, but as somebody who's like, I need to get out of here, somebody get me out of here, I need some place to go, that there are places that are established and that those people have a network amongst themselves for support.
And to a certain extent, how to obtain things like food and shelter that is not connected to a mental health center is just as important as anything else that you say you're going to do.
Yeah, I agree. And we have to talk about that.
Because at this point, most of the people are so connected to the mental health center that their very existence, whether it's their food or their shelter,
right,
is connected to it.
Yeah. It's all segregation. It's entire segregation.
It's learned helplessness.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, there are other places where people who are in need of assistance go. And if you have a psychiatric history, you're not going to the places where every other person in this country is going.
No, you're going to the place where the mental health centers.
Right.
Yes.
And that's how it funds itself, and that's why it's billions of dollars. And that money should just be put back into the general fund for assistance for people, and you shouldn't have to have some kind of psychiatric evaluation to have your basic needs met, like if you need assistance. Like, so that's, but whatever. I mean, I'm going to spill off on like a anti-capitalist rant, and some of you may not want to be associated with
economic slavery, because what happens is people get into a cycle and they say, oh, I can't work, I can't do this because I lose my check. And sometimes, and when you ask them how much the check is, sometimes you're talking about as little as $700.
Right.
So it's a chain. It chains people down. And there are even people I know who hear constantly. I have to, it's like almost a deep brainwashing process for people to say they don't have to go to their public health clinic. And even if they decided that they might still need to see a psychiatrist once every 3 months or month, that their private psychiatrist that will take their insurance. It's such a struggle, because sometimes even after a person is out of the hospital, even if they're living on their own or whatever else, it's these invisible chains. And there are going to be people that are going to need the landing zone. They need the landing zone now. We know a couple of people that have used their homes and stuff as these sort of landing zones temporarily.
That weighs on people, and sometimes people just can't do it. Sometimes people are open to having and being able to do that and wanting to do it, and there are sometimes things, circumstances, experiences, events that prevent somebody who really believes these things from doing it, because they can't, because you can't always do all for everyone. And people also need to have support around that, and that's what makes
it. There are people who will reach out and that will need it. It's just like all the slaves. Everybody that was in slavery didn't run off with Harriet Tubman they would think you'd be. There were a lot of people that were there.
Right, but what I'm saying
ended,
right.
They were people that didn't want to go.
Right, but what I'm saying is even for those people who ordinarily would be the landing zone themselves, of where somebody would be coming to them, that their entire purpose in life is to create this kind of environment, that not everybody can do it all of the time, and that there are external, and so that the more of us that can provide these kinds of environments that really do take a lot of work and effort in order to provide, they just don't come out of anywhere if you're opening your house to somebody to come in. There's a lot of work and effort and energy and resources that are needed in order to meet that. And not everyone can do it all the time. And if you can't do it, it's not your responsibility. It's not.
Amen.
The world doesn't rely on you if you can't do it. And we all do what we can. But I think this way of being able to create a conversation around it for people to learn more about it, to get involved, to create that support network of like-minded people. It's going to be on September 27th from 4 to 5 p.m. You can email ckSEAN811@yahoo.com in order to request information about what phone number to call in and such on September 27th.
Lauren, I want to thank you so much. I really think this is wonderful what you're doing. I know I'm not on a lot. Sometimes I'm exhausted. I can't get a call. But I really know, I just support everything you're doing. Talk with Kenny, I think is excellent. It's so needed now, and I'm glad you just stepped up to the plate to do it. I really am, you know.
Well, I'm excited, and it's been wonderful for me. Yvonne, Sharon, Maria, everybody out there who's listening, I'm going to ask you all to keep on speaking out. If you know of a tip or a human rights violation that needs to be exposed, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, the Talk with Tenny tip line is 718-273-8708. We will be on Wednesday night on a special at 8 to 10 p.m. and keep on speaking out, and talk to you soon. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Okay. Thanks, Lauren. Thanks, everybody.
Good night.